listen, think, learn, grow. Listen, think, learn, grow. Live, live, live.
This is the Spirit of Life Metaphysics Radio Program, exploring science and spirituality with Dr. Michael Kelly and Dr. Vicki Hunter.
Good evening and welcome to the Spirit of Life Program for Wednesday, July 23rd. My name is Michael Kelly. I'm here with Dr. Vicki Hunter.
Oh, good evening, Michael. You know, as always, I'm very glad to be here, and we have a surprise for folks tonight.
We do. I'm looking forward to it. It's going to be a fun one tonight. We're going to have a great discussion. And as always, want to just give a shout out to everybody that takes the time to join us in the live chat. We always appreciate seeing you. I know it's the highlight of my week, and we appreciate your contributions. But hey, we appreciate those that take the time to catch up with us from the archives as well, and we appreciate your feedback also. Spirit of Life is a weekly service and educational program of the International Church of Metaphysical Humanism. Our mission is to explore and empower the human spirit, as well as to explore science and spirituality. In addition to this broadcast, ICMH offers other educational programs that can be found at metaphysicsinstitute.org and tfuniversity.org. Of course, we're going to begin tonight with our 9 abbreviated principles of belief. Those are 1, do no harm, do right. 2, we believe in the indomitable power of the human spirit. The answers we seek already exist within us. 3, we believe that we alone are responsible for and capable of solving human social problems. 4, we are all equal. 1 planet, 1 race, 1 ancestry, 1 destiny. 5, we recognize and honor the divine energy that exists in all living things. 6, we are physical and spiritual beings. Consciousness survives death of the physical body. 7, self-acceptance, self-responsibility, and respect for free will create self-completeness. 8, metaphysical education and practical life skills empower the human spirit and enhance the human condition. And 9, expanding human consciousness leads to human evolution and peaceful coexistence. So tonight, we do have a very special program. We're going to be talking about numerology and the history of math. But the surprise is we have a special guest. Welcome, Dr. Mike Tickner.
Hello, everyone.
So glad to have you with us. I know it was kind of I got some great information from you that you were very kind to send, and I just on off the cuff, I asked if you want to join. You were kind enough to join us tonight to offer your expertise when it comes to math history and things like that. Of course, we're going to find some numerology too.
Dr. Mike, you studied math, did you not? Yeah. Or numbers?
Yeah.
And that was kind of your secondary in college?
Well, I had 2 minors, 1 in physics and 1 in math. And,
wow.
I've taken the math all the way up to linear algebra and differential equations.
Way out of my league. So,
I've always really liked math.
So when you were kind enough to send Michael the email about, you know, contributing something tonight, you had no idea you were going to be invited on.
No.
So Michael said, yeah, that's great to talk about. Dr. Mike says, oh, you want me on air? Yeah. So, but this email with the history of math, I was reading it over. I was fascinated because my understanding of math goes back to Pythagoras. But you go all the way back to prehistoric and ancient math before like 3000. So how does that all fit in when you talk about
Sumeria,
like geometry and such?
Well, actually, geometry came later. But yeah, I started off with the what I call prehistoric ancient math, which is before 3000 BCE. And that's back when they had, you know, they had tally marks and they counting, and that so forth, counting all that. But they also had the geometry in nature.
Yeah.
You know, they were working with that. And that's about as far back as I really can go. But a lot of it started there. Then you have the Mesopotamian and Babylonians in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And that was around 3000 to 300 BCE. But, I mean, you know, like the Babylonians developed a base 60 system, and it's actually still used in time and angles today.
Wow.
They solved the quadratic and cubic equations. And, I mean, you know, we're talking a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And they were the ones who started using accounting, like clay tablets and so forth like that.
Hmm.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, there's contrary to what a lot of people think, I mean, math goes way, way, way back.
Mm-hmm.
And
so math being in like nature, we can talk pi, you know, we can... you know, talk all mm-hmm. kinds of thing when it comes to math and nature. But you mentioned in here also about astronomy and the stars. And mm-hmm. I find that part fascinating, how they would devise some kind of mathematics toward that. Unless they're aliens.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
They had help.
Yeah, you know. I think so.
Well, but, I mean, mathematics of the pyramids, you know, that goes back to the Egyptians.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's one of those things, interesting fact about the pyramids, which there's so many things about the pyramids that are there that tells me that they're much older than what they think they are.
Right.
But one of the interesting things about the pyramids is if you take the perimeter and divide it by the height, you get pi.
Hmm.
Ah.
That's very interesting.
And pi wasn't, I mean, we're talking the Egyptians were like 3000 to 300 BCE. Getting into the Greeks, that's mm-hmm. when pi was actually formulated and so forth. So, you know, there's a lot of things about the pyramids that you kind of go, how'd they know that?
Right, right.
You know, and it's like the alignment of the pyramids.
Yeah.
It aligns with Orion's belt.
Mm-hmm.
Well, not today's Orion's belt, because it's obviously time and so forth, it has migrated off. But they can go in and they can reverse everything and go back.
Right.
And they can go back to, I think it's around 10 or 12,000 years ago, it actually lined up perfect.
Hmm.
So that tells me that the pyramids have been around a hell of a lot longer than what archaeology is saying.
Right. You know, and we're finding that out. I was just going to say, we're finding that out with so many things, including First Nations peoples in the Americas, considering that we thought they came over, you know, 13, 15,000 years ago on the Bering Strait Land Bridge, but now we're seeing this evidence from just tens and tens of thousands of years ago.
So I was reading one thing, not too long ago, where they found something that said 24,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to mention, though, pyramids are not exclusive to, you know, Egypt or Peru. There's pyramids all over the planet.
Yeah, and the thing is, they're all similar. How'd they know that?
Fascinating.
Right. I think the Egyptian pyramids, obviously, being the oldest that we know of. The Mayans mm-hmm. came along a little bit after the Common Era. But I think less known would be the pyramids in like Cambodia, right? Isn't there,
mm-hmm.
what's the name? It's an ancient site, a UNESCO site. I can't think of it. Like Wangat Khor or something like that. It's, hold on. I have a computer in front of me. I'm going to Google.
Google, it lies.
What are you talking about? Angkor Wat?
Yeah, Angkor Wat. Yep, that's exactly it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's another one. It's like, who did it and how long ago?
Yeah, I guess those are more temples that are more like ziggurat kind of stepped things, but they have domes and things. But I was just thinking of the ancient ruins and things they had there that go back a long time, you know, prior to what we would have thought.
Yeah, fascinating. So, Dr. Mike, what is, you mentioned about the Rhind mathematical papyrus. What is that? Because you say it's a key source of Egyptian math problems, but what is behind it?
What is behind it?
Yeah, like, what is it?
Because
I don't know what it is. Like, is it a formula? Is it like algebra? Or, which I wasn't good at either.
Well, I got to go back to my notes.
I love those
notes. I have to cheat.
Hey, that's why we have the notes.
At this age, we've forgotten more than we learned for good.
I'll tell you one thing that, you know, made me fascinated on the topic is how many of the things that we use in our day-to-day lives, like the 60-minute or 60-second minute, 60-minute hour, all those kind of things, the 12-base system. And that's in these notes as well, but that was something I wanted to touch on, and I've kind of spoken on it briefly. But, you know, the very early methods of counting, why we had people came up with the base 12. And there's just so many interesting things to that. Because if you look at the segments of your four fingers on one hand, you know, you get the 12. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And if you count them slowly, you know, one hand, you count the segments of your finger on that hand. The other hand, you start putting up, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You get to 5, that's 60. Hence how they began tracking time. And it was a very primal relationship with numbers, just like you talked about geometry and nature. It is, a lot of it is to improve our understanding of the natural world as a survival mechanism, which then led on to the higher concepts, like you were talking about, the algebraic things, you know, pi, you know, all of the things that Vicky, I think you mentioned earlier, Pythagorean theorem. And it goes from there, and then, of course, you get to, I want to say calculus was invented almost kind of simultaneously, but in different parts of Europe by...
Yeah, calculus was Leibniz and...
Yeah, that was Greek, right?
No, I don't think that was the Europeans and the...
Well, Newton and Leibniz, they independently developed calculus. And that was in the, you know, 1400, 1800 time period.
Right. And calculus is one of those things where when you say the word, you feel smart, but I really don't have a good understanding of what it is. I never got in. Math was never my focus, so I never did anything more than college algebra.
Basically, what it does is it takes something and breaks it down into an infinite, you know, like you take a square and you break it down into another square, into another square, into another square. And you keep getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And the reason is, like on a curved surface, you can't really calculate the area under the curve. But if you take and you go and you get another smaller piece, and you get a smaller piece and a smaller piece, at some point in time, that curve almost becomes a straight line. So when it gets infinitely small, you can take the area under that curve, and then you just sum it all the way up to what you had, and that fundamentally is how calculus works.
Fascinating.
It is fascinating.
But you ask about the papyrus. I mean, what I can tell you is it's the oldest and most significant mathematical document from the ancient Egypt. Basically, and it's basically, you know, how the Egyptians approached arithmetic, geometry, and problem solving, and things like that. It's just a document,
right?
Okay, so it's a methodology. Okay. So if we move forward now, there's so much to cover in this. By the Greeks, you know, you'd mentioned 600 BCE to 300 BCE is when we started getting, of course, you know, Pythagoras was around that time. Kepler calculus measured the Earth's circumference, which could have been done, as we know, way earlier because there's so many pyramids on the Earth. But then it went from, as you've written, a shift from a practical math to abstract and theoretical math. So can you explain that a little bit?
Well, that's when they started really thinking about expanding math into a theory, you know, into a theory, and so, as opposed to, you know, like the Pythagorean theorem. Okay, that was created through, you know, basically theoretical. It started out that way.
Well, they're just guessing.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, theory is nothing more than a guess. So what they do is they take this math and they go, well, if this equals that, then maybe that equals this, and can I prove it? So now you're starting to get into mathematical proofs and all that sort of stuff like that, and getting away from actual, you know, math, 2 + 2, or, you know, I walk 10 places that way and 15 that way and so forth, and what's the area of a square and so forth, into your more abstract things like calculus. I mean, that was really abstract.
Mm-hmm. You know,
sorry, Michael, if I can inject here, is that's around the time that the Pythagorean theorem also intimated mysticism. And that was kind of an onset of numerology, correct?
Yeah, well, actually, numerology is one of those things where it goes back a long time.
Giving numbers a mystical energy?
Yeah, I mean, you can go back to the Mesopotamian.
Oh, mm-hmm. I didn't know that.
Yeah, and there's a, I think they're called the Kladine numerology.
Hmm.
And it's of ancient Babylonian, the earliest known numerological system.
So
I don't know that much about it. I just know that's, you know, it goes back that far, and it had to do with assigning vibrational energies to letters and numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this has been my contention with numerology, because the numerology as we know it works with the English language and our understanding of that. However, Michael has said even before the program, you know, the letters of the English language has changed over the years too. So the application, the assignments may be different, but I think all root languages or symbols, you know, may have different, you know, numbers for their glyphs.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I started thinking about this about 30 years ago. I have so many multicultural clients, you know, and especially people who from China. When you ask them their name, just to plug into their energy, well, which name? So they can give me the Anglo version of their name.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't translate that Chinese version, you know, the Mandarin or anything, because those glyphs, those letters,
mm-hmm.
I have no idea what the numbers are.
Right.
So that's where I started getting confused. I said, whoa, wait a minute. Numerology is only for English. But again, there has to be some kind of mass or collective consciousness in understanding numbers, and that's why I always reduce it to 9, because there's numbers tell a story of 1 mm-hmm. to 9 being the only true numbers.
Well, the Egyptians, for example, used sacred geometry
mm-hmm.
and number symbolism mm-hmm. in temple design, pyramids, and mystical teachings. So, where they got it, I don't know.
Well, you know, again, that was what I was thinking about in terms of, early numerology. When you mentioned the Mesopotamians, I wondered if it wasn't a way to, because you can sense that some of these numbers, like prime numbers and things like that, they have a certain power to them. right? Mm-hmm. And it has almost an energy about it. And you would, when I think something that is a science or something that is a field that you can study and learn more about, when you're getting into it, there's so much of it that's a mystery. It has a mystical feel to it. Like the old adage, was it Arthur C. Clarke, any technology sufficiently advanced is indistinguishable from magic? I think that lies true with a lot of concepts. And I think math might be that one of those things, because we know that it has a power. We know it impacts the physical world. That's kind of how we put this kind of meaning into it. And just thinking about humans and how we have a relationship with numbers and how it translates into our world, I was also thinking that it was, especially with our recent history of the pandemic, a fascinating little story that one of the reasons that, for his part, Newton developed calculus, as well as many things, studying prism colors and all of that light spectrum, is because they were having a pandemic, one of the plagues that was ripping through England, so everybody was locked up and not really commuting much. So he was locked up, didn't have much to do, started focusing on math, and that's how we got a lot of things that we have today.
Here's an interesting fact about mathematics. Math is based on axioms. You know what an axiom is?
I would say an axiom is kind of like a learned truth kind of thing.
Yeah, self-evident truth.
Right.
It's a statement accepted without proof. Okay, so all math is based on an axiom which cannot be proved.
Hmm.
So does that mean math is flawed?
I think that... What aspect of math can't be proven in terms of what you're referring to? Like, are we talking about negative numbers and stuff like that?
2 + 2 = 4. Unless you go, it could be 22, you know, depending on how you look at it.
Oh, so like, in that way, I think of math as also a language. Like, have you, like, PEMDAS is something I think everybody in American schools learned. What PEMDAS, hold on, parentheses, exponents, multiplication and division, and then the addition, subtraction, something along those lines. Am I remembering that correctly?
Well, natural numbers.
Right. So, but my point being is that when you look at a formula, really you're looking at the language of math. Like, so why is 2 + 2 = 4?
Right.
It depends on what language is being used, right?
Right. So,
which I think is another interesting aspect of numerology.
They're all eventually based on an axiom.
Right.
So, I mean, it's just, it's kind of one of those strange things I look at because I'm weird, but it's okay.
It's interesting.
So if we move forward a little, because, man, I look at the clock and I say, oh, gee, this is such a good conversation. From around 300 BCE to 1200 BCE, or CE, then Indian mathematics and the concept of zero.
Yes.
Can you elaborate on that?
Well, they're the ones who came up with the idea of zero. You know, everybody just assumes that zero has always been there. It's not.
Right.
And so they came up with the number, and they call it zero. And, you know, it's a symbol. That's all it is. But I mean, when you talk about mathematics, you have to have zero.
Mm-hmm.
And believe it or not, like I said, it wasn't really a concept until that time frame.
Well, it had to
by
have been
India,
considered
in India.
Well, it had to have been considered before that. Nobody maybe wrote about it or knew about it.
Didn't have it.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Huh.
As a mathematical concept, or nobody really, you know, it was either
nobody
something
ever,
or...
you know, yeah, as a mathematical concept, zero didn't come about until they came up with it around that time frame.
So I heard Elon Musk, and he's not one of my favorite people on the planet, trust
he's
me.
He's a smart dude, but he's kind of a nutcase.
Yeah. But he came up, he was talking about that once I saw him in an interview where he said there is no zero. It's like,
it depends on how you look at it. Okay. Well, mathematically, zero divided by any number is zero.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay.
That's where
he
was going.
Any number divided by zero is undefined.
Right.
It doesn't exist.
It has its purpose. And I'll say this. I will admit Elon Musk has a certain genius when it comes to managerial organization. He's like Edison. Thomas Edison was renowned for creating all these things. He did a couple things that were really important, but largely what he did was bring a lot of people together and had a team of engineers do things. Same thing with Musk. I don't think his genius lies in mathematics or programming or anything like that. His genius lies in bringing people together that can do those things.
Yeah, he is a, you know, no doubt, he is a really smart dude.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you're right. I mean, to create something, you know, like the SpaceX and even the Tesla and things like that, one person can't do that.
No, no.
You got to have the ability to hire people that know that. Now, you know what Elon Musk's initial claim to fame was, don't you?
PayPal with Peter Thiel.
Yeah. And PayPal.
And then they were able to sell that. And also, here's another thing. Again, not trying to knock him here, because Tesla existed before Musk. But he came in, and it's the managerial experience that he could bring to play. And not only that, but he is a showman. He's got a bit of P.T. Barnum in him. And in the world of business, that's what you need to get things off the floor. You need to get pizzazz and buzz to get money to flow in so you can fund these projects.
And now he's to the point where you may either like him or you don't like him, but he's sitting back and I don't care. I got $500 million. Why do I care?
Yeah,
you know, I'm going to send somebody to the moon. Okay, fine.
Yeah.
I mean, it's something people just basically have to accept.
Right.
Yeah. That you're going to have people like that.
Well, that's always been the case. You know,
I mean, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, those two were they were terrible people persons. Mm. I mean, they would Jobs would go in and have two teams competing to build a product.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, he was ruthless. Yeah. And Windows, people don't realize who originally created Windows. Windows was stolen by Jobs and Microsoft from Xerox.
Hmm, I actually hadn't heard that. I thought it was, what's Gates' partner?
Allen?
What's his last name or first name? It's something, it's on the tip of my tongue. Again, Google's right here in front of me, but yeah, I thought he might have done a lot of work. Kind of like the whole Jobs-Wozniak thing, right? Like Steve Wozniak was kind of the brains. Jobs was the marketing managerial kind of thing, which, again, we're kind of getting off topic, although this is all interesting stuff.
Bill Gates and
Paul Allen.
Paul Allen, interesting story. This is off everything. Back in 1978, I think, or 79, a friend of mine was going to fly to Albuquerque. And he had a small plane, and I said, yeah, I'll go with you. And while I was there, he was doing his business. I decided I'd interview with this little company that I had heard about. And so I called them up, and they said, yeah, sure, come on in. And I went in, and I interviewed with them. And I came back, and I told my friend, God, what a bunch of losers. Happened to be Microsoft. And the two people I talked to was Paul Allen and Bill Gates.
Wow.
And I looked at him and I go, God, you guys are nuts. So there was my chance of fame.
Well, you know, that's not the first time in history. So there's lots of those stories. Freud was considered nuts.
A lot of his stuff's been disproven.
Who?
Sigmund Freud.
Sigmund Freud.
I mean, we can go back in history time.
Archimedes. It was Archimedes who was in Syracuse when the Romans invaded, and he was so obsessed with doing mathematical formulas in the dirt in his room that when a soldier came in, he refused to acknowledge him, and he got run through because of it. But Archimedes, he made these magnificent inventions that would have been far ahead of their time. I think they lend themselves to a lot of the mythology surrounding some Atlantean things, because he had a claw that could pick ships out of the water. He had a water screw, all of these different things. And we're getting really off topic when it comes to mathematics and numerology. But it's fascinating stuff.
I think it plays into the people who are quite genius when it comes to theories of math, formulas, and how, to me, is part of the evolution of mathematics and where we are here. But I find interesting too, from the Indian mathematics and the concept of zero going into a decimal place mm-hmm. system, then the Chinese kind of, we're into the decimal place system and the use of negative numbers. And then, what they call, what you called the, Dr. Mike, of Pascal's triangle, known in China as Huawing's triangle. So would you want to explain that one also?
Well, the, I'm going to have to look here and see what I said about that.
It's kind of like that, again, would that be a methodology of working with geometry?
Mm-hmm. Keep talking.
there's a lot of symbols in history yeah. that work with triangles and putting triangles together.
Okay. Diagrams?
Yeah.
And what I have here is it is the equivalent to what is known as Pascal's triangle. It displays binomial coefficients, basically. And it has to do with the triangular array. It's basically Pascal's triangle.
Pascal's triangles, and this is something that I hadn't really heard about. And again, if anybody were to call me smart, it's just because I might know a few words or two. But when it comes to mathematics, again, I got through college algebra. I didn't do half bad, and I was like, all right, I'm calling it quits. But spell it out for me. I want to do a little Google searching myself here.
Well, if I can just do a segue here, Viking runes, there's a symbol that all the Viking runes are in, that one symbol with all the lines, the triangles, the Z for the sun, which, by the way, Hitler did a double Z to make the swastika. And that was specifically from Norse mythology.
I thought he pulled that one from the Hindu.
There's a combination because they're very similar. But he was really into Norse mythology, too. But there is this, what we call a bind rune.
Pascal.
And that's where I was thinking you were going with Pascal's triangle.
Well, actually, Pascal's triangle, it is actually in a triangle, but, it's almost like bowling pins, so to speak.
Oh.
You start at one at the top, and then your next row down is 1, 2, 1, and then it's 1, 3, 3, 1, and it's basically, it has to do with the coefficients of polynomial of the power. Oh. And so he developed this triangle, and if you go down, you can go to like the 10th layer. Well, that would be equivalent to a polynomial to the 10th degree, and that would give you the coefficients of each term in order to actually solve that equation.
Wow.
So, I mean, there's a whole bunch of mathematical stuff around Pascal's triangle as well.
See, I'm trying to get a visual, but then something goes over my head. So.
I Googled it, and I have it on Wikipedia right now. I'm looking at it as he's explaining it, and it makes a lot more sense as I'm looking at the diagram.
There's all sorts of math involved in it, but basically, in essence, you can go down to whatever row, And it actually, the rows start at zero, not one. And it goes down, and then at whatever row it is, you can say, okay, row five or row four, which would be the fifth row, that would be a polynomial to the fifth degree. And so that means it's some number x to the 5 plus some number x to the 4th, 3rd, and so forth. And if you read across it, those numbers in that triangle would be the actual coefficients of the different terms in order to solve that equation.
Well, that's fascinating. The older I get, the greater my mind. I know that I think it was somebody in the chat, to kind of have to go back to it, said, I didn't get it as a child. Oh, it's Audra. But as you get older, you realize how useful and fun it is. So it's interesting. But all around that time period, you also mentioned about the Islamic Golden Age, which was doing more algebra, algorithms, trigonometry, number theory, astronomy, architecture, navigation, mm-hmm. and at the same time or thereabouts is the European Renaissance with the Fibonacci series, you know, and then introduction of the Hindu Arabic numerals. And,
well,
you know,
to
when
me,
I was a
European
kid, we really had...
Renaissance is kind of, you know, the two of them. You've got the Greek and the Renaissance are where, to me, really things started kind of coming together.
Well, and of course, right around that time in the Renaissance was the Descartes coordinate geometry,
yeah,
Newton
and
Leibniz.
And Descartes is... Basically, he would take and he related graphs to algebraic equations. Like, x plus 2 is a straight line. And so he saw that and he related that straight line to an equation. And that's his big contribution is... The coordinate geometry is just what it means. It's he was able to take a graph of something, whatever parabola, whatever it is, and he was able to turn around and relate that to an algebraic equation.
Heavy stuff. But he was also a philosopher. I think, therefore, I am.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And that interests me about Descartes. For me, I don't know, I could feel this arrogance with him. But again, he's such an isolated mind and, you know, fascinating mind who could take math and geometrics and in that existential learning and expanding consciousness, like to basically say a statement, I think, therefore I am.
Right.
I mean...
A fundamental truth, an axiom, exactly like you said.
Yeah, like so. To me, that I don't know that. See, this is where that evolution of math. You know, everybody has their own understanding of the start points,
right.
But this goes way back from the beginning of time as we know it for sure.
Right. Absolutely.
I mean, I think we could go back to the building of the wheel.
Which, again, wasn't that long ago, really. I mean, what, like 5,000 years ago? Jeez.
That's interesting. I don't know.
I mean, hypothetically, the Egyptians came around and their civilization began before, you know, the wheel. Of course, they incorporated it from what... Don't take my word on it. You know, double check me on this, but that's my memory of it. I'm thinking about 5,000 years ago.
Interesting. When was a wheel discovered?
Well, again, Google. But and that would be our best guess. And I think one thing that I will give to academic historians is when you talk to them, sometimes you'll get an arrogant one, but everybody worth their salt talks about this is our best understanding with what we know right now. And take everything with a grain of salt. Let's see. When was the wheel invented? Let's see, around 3500 BC.
Yeah, I was looking that up too.
Yeah.
So
Neolithic period.
I mean,
over 5,500 years ago.
That we know of.
Right, right.
Yeah,
I mean,
well, yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
the Anunnaki had them, but we don't count them.
Well, see how far we've come. You know, we moved through the 19th century and abstract algebra, and you've written down in here non-Euclidean geometry, real analysis. What is non-Euclidean geometry?
Well, Euclidean geometry is like your typical squares, triangles, ovals, things like that.
Yeah.
And when you get into non-Euclidean geometry, you start talking about dimensions.
Huh.
Oh,
that's okay. A jump.
Yep, got it.
You know, I mean,
so like you're talking 3D images.
Well, yeah, in essence,
3D.
I mean, it's kind of like. Trying to figure out how to say this. You know, you can do three dimensionals, X, Y, and Z, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Can you draw a five-dimensional object?
Yeah, right.
Got it, like a prism.
Yeah, well, no.
No, I think it's beyond our understanding, right? Because we have the three dimensions,
yeah.
Then you have
time and
space.
I mean, there's only three dimensions.
But, you know, how do you...
And I guess some people consider time the fourth dimension. But, you know, when you start talking about... you know, things in other dimensions.
Right.
That's where you get your non-Euclidean.
Right. I get it.
And,
okay.
Right. And it kind of makes sense too, because again, our first, as I'm trying to keep along, I'm not stating this as an expert. I'm trying to kind of say it so that I think I might understand it too, is that we began our understanding of mathematics, numbers, our relationship with them, how it impacted in the primal world, how it had a very real life, you know, aspect to it. And we became more abstract. We became thinking about it in much more detail. And this kind of takes that to the nth degree, it almost, it sounds like.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Because, I mean, it's what I consider weird stuff.
Yeah.
So as we move forward, because this is where I think math takes on a whole new perception for us in the 20th and 21st century. I don't even know where to go to this, except that, you know, we've got computers, AI. How does math... How can we describe that distinct relationship between math and the science that we have now?
Well, it's all based on math.
Like even AI.
Some of it's actually. I mean, it's. You know, it's very abstract. Let's put it that way.
Huh. And so abstract becomes.
You know, I'll give you a theory. You've heard of M theory, right?
Yeah.
String theory.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, string theory is based on the existence of 11 dimensions. Well, in calculus, that is basically 11th degree integration. It's like the integral of the integral of the integral of the integral. So mathematically, you can describe all these things, but to try to mentally and envision them, you can't do it. I mean, some people can.
I mean, well, yeah, I guess it depends on how well you can think in the abstract and what kind of imagination you have. But again, when you don't have the ability to practically apply it, like me, I'm one of the guys, those people, I need, you know, when I learn something well, it's because I can put my hands on it, I can, you know, mess with it, I can do
right.
It. I can learn any system by going through it and testing it, right? But when you talk about these abstract things, how can you do that? So a lot of it has to be based on, you know, again, what kind of processing power are you working with up there, right?
Yeah, it's all pure mathematics.
Yep.
I mean, that's what Einstein was all about.
Oh, man. Like, and then getting into the bending of space-time, that gets trippy in relativity.
Yeah, well, and then, I mean, you know, Stephen Hawking.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, you're talking about people that aren't... Well, I mean, I think they're probably more alien than they are otherwise. But, you know, some people just, you know, have the ability to think of such an abstract concept and be able to do something with it. But, you know, yeah. I mean, I had a real, real hard time in differential equations because that was pretty damn abstract. But,
you know, I can't help but think when it comes to our understanding of existence and truly peering back these layers of reality, I know there's a lot of things that we're kind of on the precipice of, but I think a lot of it's going to be less flashy, perhaps, and more of that kind of grinding out the work, the mathematics, this, and our ability to then go into the quantum realm, because mathematics and physics are so closely intertwined.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're just beginning to peer into the makings of existence and reality.
Well,
what is it, you know?
Yeah, quantum mechanics is, like quantum, Einstein called it the, he said something like the, he called it funny science or something like yeah. that. I can't remember.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, I mean, the quantum world is
almost, you know, impossible to define.
Well, you gotta, none of it is a fact.
It's right.
All, you know, it's all theory, but it goes back to what is metaphysics?
See, yeah. That's a broad, such, you know, a broad,
I mean,
answer to that.
Anything that is in theory, which means you can't prove it, it doesn't follow the scientific principle. They're trying to, but they can't. That falls in line with the definition of metaphysical.
Right.
So, you know, that whole thing of, you know, dark matter, string theory, mm-hmm. blah, 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 and everything like that. You can all say, well, they're dealing in the metaphysical world.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. It's kind of like Sudoku on a bigger scale, right? You know, when you know these things are here, you know, you're trying to find out what is that missing ingredient, right? What is that missing figure? That, why are the galaxies held together? What is it that's pulling these things together? Now, personally, I like to think it's the force that binds all living things and allows Jedi to do what they do, but, you know, that's just me.
Well, you know, here's the thing. I came up with this to kind of explain the idea of something you can't prove or disprove. I said that all living matter or individuals on Earth, it's constant at any one time.
Mm-hmm.
That means if you counted all the blue-green algae
right.
and everything else like that, it's a constant number.
Hmm.
And somebody, you know, I mean, people go, well, that's stupid. Well, you can't prove it. And I can't
right.
prove it, but it's not up to me to disprove it.
Well,
that's the
7.8
whole idea.
Hertz.
Do what?
7.8 hertz, you know?
Uh-huh.
I mean, if we're all vibrating at a certain magnitude, you know, with a certain magnetism of the Earth is, everything has to be sustained within that frequency. If it is larger than that, life shifts. If it's lower than that, life shifts. So it has to maintain some kind of equilibrium.
Right.
The more people, the less of something else. You know?
Yeah. Personally, I'd like to see less people and more other things, but
I agree.
That's okay.
But, oh, I think that's naturally happening anyway. You know, it's like I heard this a long time ago. I can't remember his name, but a scientist said that eventually, you know, with this big population explosion, numerically it starts to, you know, slowly dwindle back down again.
Right. Yeah,
and of course
there was a big study with rat populations, mice populations. I can't remember which one, but they let it go and let it go and let it go, and it reached a certain point at which it was constant because the new ones would be replacing the old ones that would die off. And it was
mm-hmm.
a constant, you know. Unfortunately, people aren't that way.
Right. We are
I
less
mean,
bound
they're
by
gonna, the... You know, it's like there's 8 billion of us. Well, the reality is at some point in time, the Earth can't support that.
Right.
And, you know, what that point is, I don't know. I mean, depending on who you talk to. But it's kind of one of those things where the population growth in certain countries are just out of control.
Yeah. And I think, to be clear, though, we have to, when you're listening to the news or economists, they might tell you something otherwise. Like we have, you know, the birth rate is slowed down. That's why you need immigrants, you know, to support the economy and developing. But
and you believe all that crap?
Well, ultimately, it's going to get. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, but aside from that, when you say that constant, of where it gets to the point where fewer people are having children, and again, we have nature has a way of, you know, setting things straight. And I think that, in my view, we'll go to that 8 or whatever, and then it'll start going down naturally.
And that's what I think is happening. You know,
well,
natural
disasters. I mean, you know, people act like climate change is this new thing. Climate change has been around since day one.
Right. It's
and you know, we go in and out of ice ages. Like they say, there's like, you know, been like 6 or 7 ice ages or something like that. Anyway, it's a cycle.
Right.
And we're going through that cycle. And, you know, it will go up and it'll go down.
Right.
There's been times in the geographical timeline where there's been higher CO2 concentrations than what is right now.
Right. And, I mean, I think that a lot of human development came from a lot of different climate change action throughout our history where it got very difficult to exist and only the smart of us survived.
Yeah.
That's been one of the big theories. The only thing I'll say is, you know, like even with the climate change that we're experiencing, it's still only putting off the next ice age by a few centuries or something along those lines. But it is, I think, the big danger. And again, I think some people want to say that, you know, climate change is going to be an extinction event. For some animals maybe, but not for us. It's going to make things a little tougher, and it's the speed at which it's changing that is makes it more difficult to adapt.
Well,
but we will adapt, and it's maybe unnecessary, but frankly, that ship has sailed. At this point, the ship has sailed. I mean, we're going to deal with the aftermath.
Well,
it's just
the thing you really want to worry about are the ocean currents.
Right, yeah, well, yeah, very true.
Well, the one big primary one is the elevator current, which comes up along the East Coast and, you know, flow up there. It's a major one. It's slowing down.
Yeah.
The last time that current stopped, accordingly to, you know, all the scientific people studying it, the world went into a major ice age.
Yeah.
Okay, so, I mean, there's so many things that are more directly reflective on climate change than what you hear, CO2 levels. Well, hell, right. CO2 is a byproduct of you breathing.
Right.
So it's not a poisonous gas.
Well, no, no.
And guess what? Plants use CO2.
I think methane,
that's what they bring it in, give off oxygen.
Right.
So there's so many things other than, you know, yeah, methane is a big problem. I'll agree with that. But, I mean, there's so many other things that are affecting climate change that people don't really hear about.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, it's all who you listen to.
Well, that's a big part of it. And I think one reason it's very hard to kind of get a handle on, especially when you have so many different news media sources throwing this and that and the other on, is it's a massively complex thing. You know, and it is what it is. We're going to deal with it. It is going to cause, you know, I live in Florida. I mean, we've been getting a ton of powerful hurricanes. Not that hasn't happened in the past. It's just the frequency is going up. That's all. And yeah, it's gonna be tough, but we're gonna get through it.
Just like, you know, the major flooding we've had here in Texas, and you know, people have all sorts of conspiracy theories on that. They're trying to blame cloud seeding. And so forth like that. Well, obviously, they're claiming that, but the fact is, they know very little about cloud seeding.
Right, right. It's like hard
and cloud seeding couldn't cause that. It's very, very minuscule effect at best. And the people that do the cloud seeding weren't even in that area.
Right.
So, I mean, it just amazes me what people come up with and want to believe without knowing the facts.
Well, that's the thing, you know, and also there is the entertainment factor. Some of the stuff is just to talk about and guess about.
Oh, yeah,
stuff, right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I just want to make sure we can get all the points we want to get in while we have time. We're coming up to the end of our broadcast here. So I just wanted to say, you know, we've gone through a bunch of stuff, but is there any, you know, specific point, Dr. Mike? I know I brought you on last minute, but anything you want to kind of leave us with as we kind of get into the final stages?
I'm not really sure. It's kind of one of those things where check the facts of something you want to try to believe in.
Right.
And don't just rely on one side of the coin. Dig out the facts. I mean, they're out there. It's just a matter of what you listen to.
Right.
And that's why I don't listen to the news anymore. I'll pick up some things on some of the sites that I visit. And once I do that, I go, I wonder if that's really true. And I'll dig into it a little bit until I get to the point where I go, well, this person was actually quoting out of context.
Right. And that's,
and so forth and so forth, which, you know, it's hard to tell what's true and what's not true nowadays.
And if I can,
well, this
I guess,
is why I think this is why history is so important too. When we're talking, getting back to the topic at hand, math,
right,
and learning more about, you know, who we are as a species and our evolution. Well, yeah, there's alien intervention. I believe that, or contributions is a better way to put it. But it's educate yourself. Keep educating yourself.
Right.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. And
keep learning.
And the only thing I'll say is, just like you said, Dr. Mike, context is king, you know. The context of a situation is so massively important to that situation. And so often, people try to influence you by omitting facts. They show you a partial truth. And the best lies have truth mixed in and just lead you astray on that. So again, I'm just going to back up on that, but it has been a fascinating discussion. That's what I love about these kind of things, is it's constantly flowing. We're constantly learning more, constantly changing, which doesn't mean people were lying. It means we're learning more. And I love that, because it's a constantly changing life that we live in. So
well,
that's
if anybody out there is wanting the history of the map that I put together, is there a way you can get it to them, or
can you post it
somewhere, or what?
Probably in the One Planet community on Facebook, and of course, reach out to us there. I think a lot of you see on Facebook. If you want, and if you're okay with me sharing it, you can always shoot me an email at drmichael@icmhchurch.org too. I'll keep an eye out for that, and I can forward it there too. But we can also post it on the Facebook group.
Awesome. You know, thanks for coming on late notice, Dr. Mike.
No problem.
Your take on math and numbers adds to what Michael and I said. We've been doing this a long time, and to get somebody else's take and, you know, a whole different angle in history really adds to the color of the program.
Well,
so thank you very much.
Yeah, unfortunately, we didn't really talk about numerology, but...
I don't mind. We'll get to it another day.
Yeah. But no, this has been a great discussion. We are coming up at that time. So I'm just going to say, you know, it's been just wonderful having you, especially on the fly. And I'm looking at this thing, man, I'm reading this email. I'm thinking to myself, I'd really love to talk to Dr. Mike about this. Hey, I wonder if he's free tonight. He wants to join us on the fly. And you've been very kind and very generous with your time. And I very much
appreciate that. Yeah, I'll wait for my check.
Yeah, it's coming. Believe you me. I'm telling you, the post office isn't what it used to be. So, you know.
I know. That's terrible, isn't it?
Thanks, Dr. Mike.
Absolutely.
Appreciate being here. Thanks.
Absolutely love having you. And Dr. Vicky, want to sign off with any thoughts?
Of course, don't let them push you around out there, folks.
I'm going to start putting that on a t-shirt, I'll tell you what. But no, it has been fantastic. Thank you, everybody, for joining us in the live chat. Thank you. Oh, here, T. Mueller put out, Einstein called quantum theory spooky action at a distance. So nice additions there. But I love the feedback we get. Can't wait to see you guys next week. I don't know that we have a topic yet. We might go on numerology. We might talk about any number of different things.
I think maybe next week we'll just draw cards and weigh it, and we'll see how we go.
That sounds good to me. Can't go wrong.
Yeah.
So until then, listen, think, learn, grow, and live. Good night, everybody.
Good night, everyone.